This is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on this 25th day of June 2010. Today I'm joined on the line by Dr. William Hersey. Dr. Hersey received his PhD in chemistry from the University of Missouri in 1962, worked as a senior scientist in risk assessment for the EPA, headed the EPA HQ Professionals Union. He has received numerous awards and fellowships and has published numerous articles and studies on a range of topics related to chemistry, and he has presented on the topic of fluoridation risks in a number of venues. Dr. Hersey, thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start by hearing a little bit more about your background and how you came to be interested in the topic of fluoridation specifically.
Well, I joined EPA in 1981 after spending 19 years in the chemical industry working for Monsanto Company. And immediately when I came to Washington and joined EPA, I also joined the existing labor union, which unfortunately at that time was restricted to representing only what the law here in the U.S. calls a non-professional bargaining unit. There was another group of people at EPA, the scientists, engineers, attorneys, and so forth, which fell into another classification under the U.S. law called professionals, and they were unrepresented. 1981 was the beginning of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and there was a great deal of anxiety among the workers at EPA about Ronald Reagan's statements about the environment and about organized labor, and the net result of that was that we got together and organized the labor union to protect the rights of the professionals at EPA to do the best kind of work that they could professionally, ethically, in pursuit of the mission of the agency with a minimum interference from the political types. So I joined in that effort and was one of the charter members of the union. And one of the first things that we got involved with in fighting with the agency happened to come as a result of some work that professionals did on asbestos. And basically, the agency wanted to ban certain uses of asbestos and phase down the mining of it. The long and the short of that story is that after EPA proposed those rules, suddenly they did a quick about-face and decided not to do that. It upset the professional staff enormously. We made a big stink about it, raised a lot of flack. We got covered in the New York Times and other media. And people who were concerned about fluoride in drinking water saw that, and they came to us and said, would you and your group like to hear a seminar about fluoride toxicity? And being, if you will, nerdy scientist types, we said, well, of course we'd like to hear, learn something about toxicity. At that point, most of us were like most U.S. citizens at the time, and unfortunately like many still are, thought that fluoride was a perfectly fine kind of thing to put in water, and it helped make strong teeth and so forth and so on. There wasn't any problems with it. Well, we went to hear the seminar by Dr. John Yamianis, and if you will, the scales fell from our eyes, and we saw another side of fluoride, the side of toxicity. And we began to look into the ethical issues around water fluoridation, putting something in the drinking water that was designed to affect body function and basically to act like a drug. And one of the aspects of that seminar also was to point out that EPA at that time had a proposal on the table to establish a drinking water regulation for fluoride at 4 milligrams per liter of fluoride, which we found was not justifiable scientifically. In essence, at 4 milligrams per liter, it was known at that time that up to 40% or so of people who would, children who would be drinking water at that level would succumb to severe or moderate dental fluorosis, that their teeth would become stained, pitted, basically damaged considerably. And it was quite amazing that EPA would go down that road, and because I have to explain a little bit about the Safe Drinking Water Act under which those drinking water regulations were proposed. The Safe Drinking Water Act says that in proposing what are called primary drinking water standards, EPA has to do that in two steps. The first step is to find out what level is safe in terms of not causing any known or anticipated adverse effects on health. Purely a health-related standard, which is not enforceable, but it's simply a benchmark against which then the enforceable standard is set. And the law says that the enforceable standard is supposed to be established as close to that health-based goal as technologically feasible. Well, EPA decided that they would set both of those standards, the health-based gold standard, which at that time was called the recommended maximum contaminant level, and the enforceable maximum contaminant level at 4 parts per million, or 4 milligrams per liter. And they magically made this severe dental fluorosis incidence, which everyone knew would happen at a very high rate. They simply said having rotten teeth was not an adverse health effect. It was simply a cosmetic effect. And that simply went against all logic. It went against our professional ethics, and we got into a big fight with the agency over that. As it turned out, an environmental organization, the Natural Resources Defense Council, had a lawsuit against EPA on that very point. And they came to us and said, would you be interested in filing an amicus, a friend of the court brief in our lawsuit? We would provide the legal writing and so forth, and you guys would write up the science part of it. And we said, absolutely. So we did that. Turns out that there were other concerns besides just dental fluorosis. EPA's document that they used to justify establishing this 4 milligram per liter standard was written by a contractor. It ignored other health effects, mutagenicity, that is changes in gene structure, information that indicated that it could also cause cancer and cause effects on bone. And they simply blew off all of those concerns. Well, we, in conjunction with the Natural Resources Defense Council, prepared an amicus curiae brief and submitted it in the lawsuit. But unfortunately, the U.S. District Court of Appeals that was hearing the lawsuit would not accept our amicus brief. Even though we claimed and we still believe that the labor union is a separate entity from the agency, two members of the court said it would be like EPA suing itself if the court allowed our amicus brief in to the NRDC lawsuit. Interestingly, there was a three judge panel. Two of the judges said they didn't want the amicus brief entered. Another judge said that she wanted to hear it. One of the two judges who did not want to hear our brief was Judge Bork, who was nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court but was rejected. The judge who wanted to hear our brief was Judge Ginsburg, who was nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court and, in fact, sits today on the U.S. Supreme Court. We think that was a kind of an interesting wrinkle. But so we continued to be interested in the issue of fluoride toxicity over the years. My colleague, Dr. Robert Carton, was the lead amongst those of us in the union who were concerned about that particular issue. There were many issues in which the union was interested. traditional labor union issues, conflicts between employees and managers, the traditional kinds of things, as well as these scientific ethics issues. I was sort of second to Bob Carton while this was going on. Our activities with respect to the NRDC lawsuit drew attention from other people across the U.S. who were fighting imposition of fluoridation in their local water supplies. And Bob was asked to go around to the country to talk about our opposition to increasing exposures to fluoride. We took a vote in the union to make sure that the union was in agreement with what we wanted, you know, what we were being asked to do, and we were supported by the membership. And over the years, we continue to follow the developments of research on fluoride to. And as the years have gone by, it's only reinforced our concern. Perhaps another interesting wrinkle from that time period was a British BBC radio producer, Christopher Bryson, was asked by his employers in Britain to see what the American viewpoint of fluoridation was, because there was a controversy going on in Leeds, England at the time about water fluoridation, and the BBC wanted Bryson to explore that. Well, Bryson came and talked to Bob Carton and to me, and began to investigate the whole issue. He hooked up with another investigative journalist, Joel Griffith, and ultimately they dug and dug and dug into this issue to find out how it was that water got put in the fluoride got put into drinking water supplies in the first place. And interestingly, it goes way back into the history of the 20th century. And ultimately involved the U.S. nuclear weapons program, which seems almost hard to believe, but but it's true. It turns out back in the early part of the 20th century, there were indications that people who lived in certain areas in the U.S., in Colorado and Texas in particular, where there were relatively high fluoride levels, seemed to have lower rates of dental cavities. As it turns out, there are other explanations for that besides the fluoride levels. But Secretary of the Treasury in the U.S., who happened to control at that time, the U.S. government controlled the Public Health Service, sent one of his employees out there to investigate this issue. As it turns out, the Secretary of the Treasury was Andrew Mellon, who was one of the founders of the Aluminum Company of America. Alcoa and other aluminum industries used a lot of fluoride and emitted to the environment a lot of fluoride, and it was a well-recognized toxic agent in the environment and in the health of workers in those facilities. Mellon asked an employee of the Public Health Service, a fellow by the name of Trendley Dean, to go and see if he could find any evidence that could be used to help support sort of cleaning up the image of fluoride. And he went out and investigated, put together a statistical analysis of what came to be known as the 28-city study, which showed a beautiful and, as it turns out, properly incredible graph showing a beautiful correlation between the amount of fluoride in drinking water in these 28 cities and the incidence of dental fluorosis. That is, the more fluoride, not dental fluorosis, but dental cavities, the more fluoride that was in the drinking water, the fewer cavities that people had. Turns out he actually looked at more than 28 cities, and he cherry-picked the data for the 28 cities that gave this beautiful graph. As a result of that work and some other work done by another researcher who was on contract to Alcoa by the name of Gerald Cox, ultimately in 1939 a proposal was made by Cox to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, that they ought to put fluoride in their drinking water and improve the dental health of the people in Johnstown, PA. Turns out that the good city council of Johnstown said thank you but no thanks. And interestingly, the American Dental Association during that time period also said, whoa, this proposal to put fluoride in drinking water, that's we don't know enough about it. We know that fluoride causes certain kinds of bone problems, and we don't think that's such a great idea. So 1939 also saw the outbreak of World War II, and at least in the West, World War II was started in 39. In the Pacific, it was going on before that. But one of the things that developed was a contact with nuclear physicists between nuclear physicists. Albert Einstein ultimately wrote a letter to President Roosevelt pointing out the work that had been done in Germany in the 30s, showing that certain nuclei would split when hit by neutrons, and large amounts of energy could be released in that kind of nuclear reaction, and urged the U.S. to undertake a program to develop this as a form of energy. And in fact, that was the beginning of the Manhattan Project. Well, as it turns out, the form of uranium that undergoes nuclear fission constitutes much less than 1% of the uranium that exists in uranium ore. Uranium-235 is the kind that undergoes fission. U-238 does not undergo fission. In order to separate the U-235 from the much more prevalent U-238, the way that was done was to convert the uranium to a gas, uranium hexafluoride. And a principle of chemical physics is that lighter gases that have less mass, move slightly faster than gases that have greater mass. And U-235 is just ever so slightly less massive than U-238 hexafluoride. And so in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, U.S. built a gaseous diffusion plant and was using a lot of uranium hexafluoride to prepare U-235 for use in a weapon. The process by which the uranium hexafluoride is made is to succinctly involves the use of a gas, hydrogen fluoride, reacting with the uranium compounds to make the uranium hexafluoride. Hydrogen fluoride, the gas, at the time was mostly being made at a plant in Deepwater, New Jersey by DuPont Corporation. And there was there had been a lot of release of HF, hydrogen fluoride, sort of on a routine basis that was causing damage in the local area. Window glass was being etched. Hydrogen fluoride is an extremely reactive, nasty compound. It dissolves glass, for instance. Then there was a massive accidental release of hydrogen fluoride, which did huge amounts of damage to the agriculture in South Jersey. And lawsuits were filed against DuPont for that. At that point, that's when the U.S. government got involved in this, in the issue of fluoridation. The War Department, the Food and Drug Administration, Public Health Service, and others, Leslie Groves from the Manhattan Project, got together in Washington, and the decision was made, rightly or wrongly, that we could not have defense contractors being subject to these kinds of lawsuits, because the U.S. defense was strongly dependent on nuclear weapons, and we simply couldn't tolerate having that kind of problem. And so at that point, in 1945, the U.S. government got behind cleaning up the image of fluoride by going back to the work that had been done by Trenley Dean before, and started the idea of making fluoride a miracle solution to dental cavities and putting it into drinking water systems. And that's one of the big reasons why we have such a problem now dealing with the issue, because it's the U.S. government has been on this track for a long time. Governments hate to admit ever having made a mistake. So there we are. Without getting into greater detail about how the whole thing was sold, perhaps a bit of digression there. A person who was the father of public relations, who sold such things as women's rights to smoke cigarettes and thought that smoking cigarettes was a great idea, was brought in to mastermind the public relations aspect of making water fluoridation palatable to the U.S. population. And what happened was, he said, basically what you need to do is get to opinion leaders, to the heads of the American Dental Association, the American Medical Association, and places like that, and get them on board. People trust their doctors, people trust their dentists, and if you can get them on board with this, then the battle will be won. And in fact, the patriotic duty aspects of this were a big part of the selling job.
Edward Bernays.
Edward Bernays. Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you for reminding me that. But that was the approach, and so you see ADA funneling money into dental schools and so forth and so on, pushing dentists into taking up the crusade at the local level to get fluoride in the drinking water, issuing statements like to the effect, it's an abrogation of your professional duty if you don't get involved in campaigns to put fluoride in drinking water and that sort of thing. So you have all this massive push in that direction. In the beginning, the fluoride was mostly coming from the aluminum industry. But it wasn't very long into the fluoridation program before it was realized that there was another source that would be available, and that's the source which is the primary source nowadays and has been for decades, and that is the byproduct from phosphate fertilizer manufacturing, both here in the U.S. and other places. When phosphate ore is dug up out of the ground and ultimately converted to phosphate fertilizer, a byproduct of that reaction of that ore with sulfuric acid, which is part of the process by which the ore is converted to fertilizer. When when that stuff coming out of the ground is reacted with sulfuric acid, other things that are mixed with the ore, like sand and calcium fluoride, these ores are old marine deposits from old ocean beds. And in the U.S., this is mostly down in Louisiana and Florida. The byproducts include silicon tetrafluoride and hydrogen fluoride. And when these get out into the atmosphere, they cause great damage. And so in order to prevent that from happening, these are gases. Both of these are gases, silicon tetrafluoride and hydrogen fluoride. The gas stream is essentially washed with water. Its water is sprayed into the gas stream. And the hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride combine with the water to form a solution of hydrofluosilicic acid or hexafluosilicic acid. It goes under a couple of different names, but it's the same stuff. Two atoms of hydrogen, one atom of silicon, and six atoms of fluorine. And this is the stuff now which is used in over 90% of the fluoridation systems in the U.S. Most people, and in fact, probably most dentists for that matter, think that the fluoride in drinking water is the same pharmaceutical grade material that's in toothpaste and in mouthwash and in dental varnishes and so forth. But it's not. It's this industrial byproduct. It's somebody trying to call in on my phone, so we'll have to deal with the beep here for just a moment. The result of the fact that this stuff is an industrial byproduct from this relatively crude, if you will, mining process, is that other impurities come along with it, including arsenic and heavy metals such as lead, and some radionuclides as well. In fact, the person who was at the time the Public Health Service's national fluoridation engineer, Tom Reeves, admitted that most of the arsenic in drinking water systems that are derived from surface water supplies, like, you know, that is, you take water from the river, most of the arsenic that ends up in the drinking water doesn't come from the river. It comes from the fluoridation chemical that's put into the drinking water. Groundwater drinking water systems, especially in the western part of the U.S., that is the water that comes percolating up out of the ground, that contains natural levels of arsenic, which are substantial. And so, but most of the water systems in the U.S., especially in large metropolitan areas, most of that is surface water supplied. And so most of the arsenic that people, for instance, in New York and along the East Coast and along the Mississippi and Ohio River valleys and so forth, the arsenic that they're getting in their drinking water system is coming from the fluoridation chemical.
Well, this is a key point, and from my layman's perspective, it's something that I've been wondering about, because obviously the vast majority of the public believes that we're dealing with sodium fluoride and a pharmaceutical-grade chemical, and as you say, many dentists think that. My question is, do the EPA, when they're trying to come up with their regulatory standards, do they take into account the difference between sodium fluoride and fluorosilicic acid and the different impurities in that, or is it simply fluoridation when they look at the fluoride levels? Is it from a multitude of sources?
Well, you have to understand EPA's role in water fluoridation. Now EPA doesn't mandate water fluoridation. It's strictly a local operation, nor, in fact, do they regulate the chemicals that are used in fluoridation. EPA long ago surrendered the regulatory authority over chemicals that are used in water treatment plants to an operation that was once called the National Sanitation Foundation and is now simply known as NSF Incorporated, and lets the NSF, which draws its membership and technical staff from water authorities, from other industrial sources. One former EPA water official, as a matter of fact, went to work for NSF as well, Joe Cotrugo. And the NSF sets a standard, they have a variety of standards, but the one that's most applicable is what's called Standard 60, and which says that any water treatment chemical cannot contribute more than 10% of any contaminant that is listed as that has a drinking water, a primary drinking water maximum contaminant level set by EPA, which is a big mouthful. But what it means is this: if the water authority wants to put hydroflow silicic acid into drinking water, and EPA has set a maximum an enforceable maximum contaminant level for arsenic at 10 parts per billion, then when the hydroflow silicic acid gets put into the drinking water, no more than one part per billion of arsenic can come in with it. One, basically, that's the maximum of 10% of the enforceable standard. And that's the same for any other water treatment chemical and any other contaminant that's regulated by EPA, no more than 10% of a regulated material, MCL, can be added. So EPA basically doesn't play in this game, nor does the Food and Drug Administration, for that matter, play into this game in drinking water chemicals. It's strictly handled by this private sector organization, NSF Inc. It's kind of an amazing thing.
It certainly is amazing, and it's somewhat disturbing. So does NSF actually figure into the Safe Drinking Water Act, or is that regulated by another agency?
No, the Safe Drinking Water Act is administered by EPA. But what NSF does in setting its, establishing these standards is simply, NSF has simply established this so-called Standard 60. And it is based on whatever levels that EPA decides a maximum contaminant level is going to be set at. So EPA sets the maximum contaminant level, and then NSF says, in order to receive certification that your product, addressing this to some supplier in Florida who wants to sell this acid to, say, Washington, D.C.'s Water Authority, NSF says to the supplier down in Florida, in order for your material to be certified by NSF, you have to tell me that there's not going to be any more than one part per billion of arsenic is going to end up in the drinking water supply of Washington, D.C. based on the stuff that you ship up to Washington, D.C. for them to put in their drinking water. And that's the very loosey-goosey, if you will, way in which this stuff is regulated. And as it turns out, interestingly enough, arsenic has, as a health-based standard, now this is the non-enforceable health-based standard, is zero. So EPA is saying no water supply, from a health-based standard, no water supply should have any arsenic in it. And yet everybody seems, in the regulatory community, seems perfectly happy to step back and say, even though there shouldn't be any arsenic in this water, it's okay to dump some in as long as it's coming in with this fluoridation chemical. That's outrageous.
It certainly is. Well, getting on to the health effects issues, I know back in June of 2000, you testified before the U.S. Senate hearing on the Safe Drinking Water Act, and that's something that I've played before on the podcast, so I'm sure some of the listeners will be familiar with your testimony there. But obviously, 10 years has elapsed, and a lot of new studies have come out. What are some of the most compelling studies that have come out in recent years talking about the health effects of fluoridation?
Well, most recently, in fact, in 2006, the National Academy of Sciences here in the U.S. Their subsidiary organization, the National Research Council, was contracted by EPA to review EPA's drinking water standards for fluoride. And in 2006, the National Research Council completed its work. I'll give you some of the details later, but the punchline, the conclusion of the National Research Council's study was a message to EPA saying, in effect, the 4 parts per million drinking water standard is not protective of public health. Do a risk assessment and establish a new standard. That was 2006. EPA just this spring said, this is 4 years after receiving the NRC report, 4 years afterwards, EPA published a notice in the Federal Register saying, we've heard from the National Research Council that we need to do a new risk assessment on fluoride, and so we're asking for comments on what we should be doing about that. In other words, after 4 years sitting on this document that says their standard is not protecting of public health, instead of saying, wow, this is something we need to pay attention to, we just spent a whole ton of money on this study by NRC. We spent a whole bunch of public money on this, and so we're not going to take it too seriously. We're not going to, for instance, we could, you know, if we really wanted to, we could set an interim standard, which we had back before 1985, when this whole business of when the union got involved in the first place, EPA was operating on an interim standard then. But instead of setting an interim standard now, say cutting the current standard in half, or cutting it into one fourth, by, you know, frankly, I think it should be down the maximum contaminant level. The enforceable maximum contaminant level has to be well under 1 part per million. But instead of setting an interim standard like that, they say, well, now we'll get started on doing a risk assessment, and down the road, maybe in another 4 or 5 years, we might be in a position where we could send out a proposal to change the standard. It is virtually waste, fraud, and abuse for the agency to have spent the money on the NRC study, to receive the report from the NRC saying your standard is not protecting public health, and to do nothing about it except say, oh, I guess we need to do another study. So that's, and that's sort of cutting to the chase. The details of that are that in the NRC study, they find compelling evidence that at 2 parts per billion, there's increased risk of bone fracture, a well-documented increased risk of bone fracture at 2 parts per million. There are impacts on thyroid function. Fluoride had been used, especially in Europe, back in the 40s and 50s, to suppress overactive thyroids as an agent for people who had overactive thyroids. It would be given fluoride to suppress thyroid function. The analysis of the current exposures in the U.S. indicates that there are many people in the U.S. who are now getting fluoride from both drinking water and the amount of fluoride that's in the food chain and through exposure via dental products, well above the levels that were shown to cause suppression of thyroid function when it was used as a therapeutic agent for that. So, number one, suppressing the thyroid in general populations does a number of things, including could be contributory to obesity. But a really critical part of that is that for pregnant women whose thyroid function is suppressed. There is a well-known correlation between suppressed thyroid function and birth of mentally handicapped children. This is a well-known and well-recognized phenomenon, and for EPA to allow that to go on is not a good thing. So, thyroid suppression, increased bone fracture risk. There are studies coming out of China now that are well-designed studies showing the impact on the IQ of children. It's known that fluoride passes the blood-brain barrier, especially in the early years when the blood-brain barrier is not well developed. A number of studies coming out of China now show roughly a 5 to 10 point suppression of IQ, comparing populations of kids in areas that are exposed to fluoride levels that are quite low to kids who live in areas where dental fluorosis is endemic, and levels have been measured in the range of EPA's current drinking water standard, 4 ppm. Who wants to have their kid suffer 5-point loss in IQ or a 10-point loss in IQ? That's one thing on an individual basis. On a population basis, it has another kind of significance. What it does is it skews the distribution of IQs down toward the low end. Basically, we're knocking off people at the high end. We're knocking off, lowering the number of people in the extremely high IQ range, people that we need desperately, high IQ folks, and we're increasing at the low end of the curve, we're increasing people with way deficient IQs who contribute problems to society. It's not necessarily going to be their fault, but as a society, we are shifting the IQ curve toward away from the high end and down toward the low end. That's a real problem on a population basis. Then, at the same, almost simultaneously with the NRC's report coming in to EPA, there was published in the peer-reviewed literature the results of a cancer epidemiology study done at Harvard, showing that young pre-adolescent boys who drink fluoridated water have anywhere ranging up to about 5-fold increased risk of osteosarcoma. Now, osteosarcoma is a relatively rare tumor. There's no question about that. It's not like, you know, we're having, you know, huge numbers of osteosarcoma develop across the country. But nevertheless, the individual risk is increased by about a factor of 5 in young boys in the pre-adolescent growth spurt phase, that is age roughly from 7 to 9 years of age when their bones are developing rapidly. This was published in the peer-reviewed literature. The study on which it was based was a PhD thesis done by person named Elizabeth Bassin at Harvard. Her research advisor was Chester Douglas, who presented a paper to the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Research Council's committee that was reviewing EPA's drinking water standard, presented an 11 by 8 and a half single sheet of paper, one side that said final report on a study that was sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences here in the U.S. And it said, basically found no correlation between water fluoridation and the incidence of osteosarcoma. He presented that data in 2003 to the NRC committee, or 2004. But at any rate, the point of that is that he had, before he had presented that piece of paper to the National Research Council's committee, he had already signed off on the thesis work of Elizabeth Basson that found exactly the opposite of that, which was kind of an amazing piece of scientific ledger domain, that he could sign off on a thesis that said little boys are at roughly 5 times increased risk if they drink fluoridated water, and he turns around and tells the National Research Council that there's no connection.
Well, it begs the question not only why he would do that, but also why studies about IQ related to fluoride are coming out from China, and as I understand, India and Iran have also been conducting these types of studies, but not in America. Why are these studies not being duplicated in America?
Well, that's a good point. It's you've seen the old when I was little, anyway, there used to be this little cartoon of three chimpanzees, one with hand over eyes, one with hand over mouth, and one with hand over ears, saying, "See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil." And that's the story about fluoride and U.S., especially government-sponsored science in the U.S. If we don't want to know about it, thank you very much, so we're not going to do it. But in China, where fluoride is a well-recognized environmental toxicant of grievous proportions, they have very big problems with fluoride in China, and in India, where groundwater supplies deliver a large amount of fluoride. Really good studies, and a lot of them are done on IQ, on other kinds of endocrine effects, on reproductive toxicity, and the studies coming out of India have shown suppression in both male and female fertility as a function of fluoride intake. So places where they're not invested in a government program to put more and more and more of this stuff out into the food chain and into the water supply, they want to know what the toxicity is. In the U.S., we do not want to know. The government will not support that, at least not to the extent that it's supported in other places. And further, people who have looked at it in the U.S. have suffered greatly at the hands of the scientific establishment and the hands of government. Phyllis Mullinex is a well-recognized toxicologist, and in fact ran the Forsyth, the toxicology department at the Forsyth Dental Clinic, again at Harvard, and was asked to study the neurotoxicity of sodium fluoride. She was very reluctant to do that because she didn't think it was, going to be any, it wasn't going to be a fruitful line of study. But when she got into it, she in fact found that when pregnant rats were given fluoride that caused their blood serum levels of fluoride to be equivalent to the serum level of fluoride in humans who drink water at the current EPA drinking water standard, when those pregnant rats delivered their litters, the young rats were born with hyperactivity syndrome, essentially, and they remained hyperactive throughout their life. Another study, a follow-up study by a scientist named Guan, who's now now working in Sweden, showed that this was caused by the change in brain cell membrane levels of a critical chemical. So Guan's study showed on a molecular basis the reason why Phyllis Mullinex was seeing the things that she saw in rats. So a really good work done there by Phyllis Mullinex and by Guan. Turns out that when Mullinex presented her work internally at Forsyth, they said, wow, that's interesting. And she said, well, I wanted to publish this. and they forbade her to publish it. She said, in essence, this is too important not to publish. And she published it, and they fired her. And that is exemplary of the kind of things that happen to scientists in the U.S. who find bad things out about fluoride. They're basically shunted off to the side. She's not had any significant institutional position since then. And a similar kind of thing happened to our the senior drinking water toxicologist at EPA, Bill Marcus, when the animal study of carcinogenicity of sodium fluoride was published first back in 1990. And the finding was clear evidence of carcinogenicity in male rats. That sent shockwaves through the public health service and through the whole pro-fluoridation community in the U.S. They quickly convened a committee that went back and changed the outcome. They were able to make certain other the way the cancer classifications are handled in these kinds of national toxicology program bioassays is to look at the overall incidence of all kinds of cancer that would develop as a result of exposure to some particular chemical. What this review committee did was to go back and cancel out certain rare cancers of the liver that occurred in the male rats and said they weren't really cancers. They were only benign tumors. But they couldn't make the osteosarcomas go away. And so the result was that this committee changed the official rating of sodium fluoride from clearly carcinogenic in male rats to equivocal carcinogenicity in male rats. Well, Bill Marcus, who is a trained toxicologist and was the senior toxicologist in the Office of Drinking Water, just hit the fan when that happened and basically said so at a presentation at the National Press Club here in the U.S. in Washington. EPA fired him. He sued EPA to get his job back and eventually was reinstated and awarded compensatory damages and so forth and so on. But that's the kind of thing that happens to people who go against the national program in the U.S. It's a very risky business for scientists in the U.S. to find out anything or say anything bad about fluoride.
Well, Dr. Hersey, attempting to draw this conversation to a close, I think this is the type of issue that is quite demoralizing for a lot of people out there because they see things like that and they realize that even the scientists out there and the members of the EPA Professionals Union have had such difficulty attempting to go against the pro-fluoridation lobby and all of the momentum and inertia behind that in the government. And people tend to get demoralized about this. But what can you say about the role that citizens out there can play in bringing political attention to this issue and putting pressure to bear on these agencies in hopefully changing the way that the fluoridation issue is looked at?
Well, the good news is that in many locations where people get organized and form local committees, they can fight off this effort on a local basis to put fluoride in their drinking water. So it's a matter of organization and informing oneself of the scientific issues and the moral issues. This is, in fact, a medical treatment that's being delivered through the drinking water system. That's one of the reasons why most of Europe doesn't do it. There are two reasons. One is it's not effective. Europe is aware that it's not effective when fluoride is delivered that way. And two, and a very important point, is that it is a matter of individual choice. You don't deliver medicine through the drinking water system. So people inform themselves of those issues and the fact that other places don't fluoridate for those two reasons, toxicity and it's an infringement on individual rights. They can often prevail in these local elections on fluoridation. They fight the dental establishment. Not all dentists have succumbed to the pressure of the ADA. There are many dentists out there who are ethically straight and do the right thing and support citizens. That's another way to strengthen any local organization, is if you can find a dentist in your local community, talk this up with your dental professionals, and include as many of those kind of folks, dentists and doctors, in your organization as you can. You can fight this on a local basis. We are continuing to fight this through other organizations like the Fluoride Action Network. I have students working here at American University on a petition to try to get hydrofluosilicic acid banned as a fluoridating agent, based on the fact that it's putting arsenic in the drinking water and there shouldn't be any arsenic at all. People should take heart that there are many people fighting this issue, including those of us who are, you know, fighting it in a centralized way. But don't give up. Never give up.
Well, absolutely. When we give up, we are basically forfeiting the fight to the other side. And certainly, people have to keep in mind that this is an issue that is not an abstract scientific debate, but goes right to the heart of medical freedom and the freedom to choose whether or not to be medicated through forced medication in the water supply, an extremely fundamental issue. So I trust that my listeners will understand the gravity of this situation. But if people are interested in finding out more about your work and the work of others on this extremely important issue, are there any websites, videos, or any other literature you'd like to recommend?
Well, the Fluoride Action Network website.
FluorideAlert.org.
FluorideAlert.org is the place to go for information. It is a well-maintained website that has lots of leads into the scientific literature, into the ethical literature, and news of local fights that are going on and that sort of thing. It is the place to go for information and encouragement.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Hersey, I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today and sharing your knowledge of this incredibly important subject, and all the best to you in your future endeavors along this in this work as well.
Thank you very much, and thanks for raising this topic.